whistle in, I guess, right? Well, or that was the foxhole one.
That was the foxhole one. But,
good evening, everybody out there. I'm Tom, W5KUB, and this is Amateur Radio Roundtable. We're on every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. I forgot the time. Our show is also broadcast on world famous WBCQ, the International Shortwave. And let me just make a quick announcement for you people out there that might be listening on WBCQ. We just moved to WBCQ's 7490 transmitter. So we got a new time slot. This show can be heard on Thursdays from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. on 7490 kilohertz on WBCQ. And back in the olden days, that would have been, kilohertz. Cycles. There were kilocycles back in the olden days, man, but we're not back here. So listen, hey, if you're out there listening on shortwave, we want to invite you to join our Facebook group. It's called W5KUB, and we've got over 11,000 hams in that group now. We'd love to have you join our group. And you can watch the show live. We're live every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Central Time. On W5KUB. All of our shows are recorded. You can watch them at any time. So just want to let you know about that. Just a couple of announcements real quick. Hey, talk to Anthony tonight on the net. 40 meter net. The boom was terrible tonight. But we had 3 or 4 stations get through. So Anthony down in Texas, he and his wife are still getting over COVID. The COVID-19, I think he's doing okay. He sounded okay. Also, I haven't heard from Ken. He's another one of our members. He and his wife had COVID. And I just saw the chatter in the Bruce, N7XGR has the COVID right now. And I did not know that. Bruce usually checks in on that every week, and I did not know that. So, guys, take care of yourself there, and hopefully you'll kick that thing real soon there. Our net tonight, we went to a different frequency tonight. I think we were on 7189, or something like that. I saw a note where the ARL sent out a message saying that the Caribbean hurricane net, we were trying to pass some traffic in the Caribbean, and we were using 7180. That's the frequency that we would normally use for our net. I did tune in to 7180, and there were a couple of real strong guys was, was chatting on there. I guess they hadn't got the message. So, we did move off of there. My good show tonight, Alan's going to talk about some different signals and I think the modulation envelope and how they look like and so forth. And we've got Bill on here. Bill, he is our master of high-altitude balloons, and Bill's going to tell us and give us an update on W5KUB-20, where it is and where it got stuck and where it's going to go. We got Glenn on here, he's got something to go. So, not sure what all else we're going to talk about tonight. Don't know how much time it's going to take, but we're going to have fun doing it, and we'll see where it goes. So, Let's pick up Alan real quick. And Alan, first let's go around the room here. Alan, how you doing?
Hey, hanging in there. Work's been pretty busy, and been pretty busy with stuff outside of work as well. But I just playing around after our session last week on the 260. And since I have all my 260s up here, I took a picture of one of the Tesla ones that I used as my background here. And, you know, afterthought here, I should have done that before the show last week. It would have been a much more apropos thing. But anyway.
Well, the background is maybe
a week after the time. After time, I've got backgrounds that are really tight, so looking into it. So, anyway, tonight on Tech Tips, I thought we'd chat a little bit about spectral content of different types of modulated signals, like CW signals, AM, upper sideband, lower sideband, FM.
Okay. Hey, before you get into it, let's pass it around and say hi to Glenn and Bill there, and we'll come back and we'll jump right into your presentation.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just introducing you.
Okay.
No problem. Yep, no problem.
Very good there. Very good. Okay. Glenn. Come on in here, Glenn. How you doing, Glenn?
Oh, hanging in there, man. I'm probably about 2 weeks away from finishing the book. Just cranking stuff out daily. I have a couple pictures of one or two of the projects in the book. And like I said, it's getting real close to finally being done. I mean, that's about 3.5 years worth of research and putting together. So it feels good to be that close.
That's good. I know you'll be glad to get through with that book so you can start the next one.
No.
Oh, man. All right. We'll see what else you got to talk to us tonight about. I know it's going to be interesting. Bill Brown. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Well, very good. You've been working. You know, you don't seem to be as active on Facebook or whatever as you used to be. You must be working more.
Oh, yeah, it's been pretty busy. We're doing a lot of Zoom conferences online and been doing some school events where I talk about space science and ham radio to kids around the world. I just did one to a school in Melbourne, Australia. And it was kind of neat because I was actually talking to the future. It was 7 o'clock in the evening, my time, and it was 11 o'clock in the morning in Melbourne, Australia, the next day. So, but they had great questions, and they actually launched a balloon. I talked them through the process of launching a balloon, and it went out off the coast of Australia, and went, the second day it went past Tasmania, and last I heard, it was on its way towards Antarctica.
All right. All right. I hope you get all the detail about Danish 20. I want to know what's going on.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a little while. All right.
Okay.
Let's jump back over to Alan. Alan, let's talk about signals and how they look going through the river.
Yeah, it's probably an interesting topic because, you know, people are always wondering, you know, am I too close to the band edge? What about if I'm on upper sideband or lower sideband? Or I need to tune up my antenna. Where should I be tuning? You know, where I'm not interfering with the folks that are chatting and that type of thing. So without getting a better understanding of spectral content, the signals might be helpful. So with that, let's see. Let's go and share a little bit of content here about this guy. So, spectral content on amateur radio signals. Not going to be a long PowerPoint. I've got like 3 slides here just to kind of illustrate the point here a little bit. And so, in most cases, we're going to talk about the spectral content of tone signals, but we'll actually talk about the signal view and some other things as well. So, the first thing to think about generally is that what's the spectrum of your audio signal itself? Of course, it's going to vary with everybody's voice. It's going to vary with what you're saying. It's going to vary with the fidelity of which it's being transmitted. I mean, the human voice can occupy frequencies you know, below 50 hertz all the way up to and above, even 10 kilohertz or more, if you start thinking about the S's and little tips and teams that are in your voice. But the most communication quality audio, phone quality audio, is typically about 2.4 kilohertz wide. You know, 100 hertz to 2500 hertz is about the frequency range that most phone transmitters will do. Some will go up to about 3000 or 3500 hertz for kind of the Hi-Fi CW or single sideband guys, or even a little bit wider. But most phone quality audio is, the meat of it, if you will, is in this 100 hertz to 2500 hertz bandwidth. So that, the bandwidth of the audio signal, how much spectral content the audio signal occupies, has a direct impact on the spectral content of a modulated RF signal. So the first one and the easiest one to think about up front is amplitude modulation, or AM. When you take a simple carrier, without any modulation at all, you just have layer G essentially at the carrier frequency and nothing on either side. Okay. Amplitude modulation creates essentially equal but inverted sidebands on either side of the carrier. And the carrier is actually still there. Okay. For a perfectly linearly modulated, even 100% modulated carrier, amplitude modulated signal, half the power is actually in the carrier. And the other half of the power is split between the upper and lower sidebands. So, by its very nature, AM is somewhat inefficient because there's duplicate information in the upper and lower sideband. They have the same information, it's just spectrally inverted on the lower sideband. It's kind of flipped around like a mirror. Okay, but the same information is there. So, you're sending the same information in two places instead of one. So, it's inefficient from that standpoint. It occupies, therefore, twice the bandwidth that it needs to in order to transmit that information, because you really only need one sideband, not the other, in order to get the information through. And the impact of that is, less people can be on the bands because the signal occupies more bandwidth. And, having a receiver that has twice the bandwidth to receive it means you're also going to receive twice the amount of noise. Now, the signal-to-noise ratio is going to be worse because of the wider bandwidth, and therefore it's harder to hear weak signal. And then third, half the power that you're sending to your transmitter or sending out to the antenna is in a carrier which is containing no information content. It's just energy in that carrier. So this is why, as we move down the road, that people are looking at using upper or lower sideband, because you take the energy away from the carrier, you take the energy away from the lower sideband, or one of the sidebands, and you can concentrate all that energy into one sideband and use less bandwidth and get more efficient that way. So it's going to be helpful to actually look at this too, as well as and what we're looking at here. So we're going to do that here in a moment. I'll actually fire up a rig and send it into a spectrum analyzer and actually look at it live. We'll do that here in a moment. But this is what AM looks like. I mean, you've got upper and lower sidebands that are equal but mirrored around the carrier. Okay, when you do amplitude modulated signals. So you have to think about, if you're operating AM, so you want to ensure that your signal doesn't go outside of the band edge. You have to kind of consider the width of your audio signal. Okay, and therefore the width of the transmit filter in your rig. Are you going to go 2500, 3 kilohertz, wide on either side of the carrier? So you don't want to get in within, say 3 kilohertz of the band edge, upper or lower, and with your AM signal because of that. Okay. Again, because repetitive modulation is inefficient for those number of reasons, this is why we started to do upper and lower sideband. So, simple sideband modulation essentially removes the carrier, suppresses it, pushes it away, depending on the mechanism. It could be a pulse process, it could be a fading method, there's a number of ways of actually doing that. You get rid of the carrier, you're also getting rid of one of the sidebands. So at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're transmitting just the upper sideband, which is the upper sideband that would be part of the AM signal, or just the lower side boom that would be from the AM signal. So removing the carrier and removing the unused sideband. So the frequency that you occupy, let's say for upper sideband, is going to be everything above, you know, your audio signal essentially above the suppressed carrier frequency. So if you dialed your radio into, say, you know, 14.200 megahertz, okay, that's where the suppressed carrier would be. But your upper sideband signal occupies, you know, a couple of, you know, 50 or 100 hertz above 14.200, all the way up to close to 2.5 or 3 kilohertz above 14.200. But, you know, the other thing is that you don't actually have any energy at 14.200. So if you were going to go down to the lower edge of the band, you could go right down to your suppressed carrier frequency, provided you know that your lower side band is being suppressed sufficiently, and still be in band. But if you're going to the upper side of the band, you have to recognize the fact that your signal is occupying as much as 2.5 or 3 kilohertz above your display frequency, which is the suppressed carrier frequency. So if you're going to go up to 14.350, you got to go 14.350 minus about 3 kilohertz to ensure that the high end of your upper sideband doesn't exceed that band edge. So this also has some implications. So let's say you got to hear a bunch of friends on, say, 14.220, but you got to tune up your antenna. Where do you go to tune up? Well, you say if you're slightly off frequency, you can tune up in an area where they won't hear you. And in the case of upper sideband, you want to tune just a little bit below your suppressed carrier frequency. You don't even have to go that far, right? Because once you're outside the suppressed carrier frequency, so instead of 14.220, you went down to 119.5, you're 500 hertz below the suppressed carrier frequency. It's not going to be in the upper sideband. So when you tune up with your single carrier, like on CW really quick, you won't be heard. Or if you went 500 hertz the other way, you're going to be right inside that upper sideband. So tuning just below the suppressed carrier when you're doing the upper sideband, you can tune up very close to the desired frequency without interfering with the folks that are already talking there. Similarly, the lower sideband, it works the other way. You still suppress the carrier, but now all of the energy in the lower sideband exists below your display, suppressed carrier frequency. So again, you're sitting at the 7.180 to talk on the net, talking on lower sideband. If your radio is working properly, you don't actually transmit any energy at 7.180. All your energy is essentially the width of your voice, your audio signal, 2.5 to 3 kilohertz, or spread around from just below 7180 down below that. So again, if you were wanting to get up on the net on 7180, if you tune just a few, 100 to 300 kilohertz on the high side of 7180, you won't be heard by everybody that's in the net. But if you tune off frequency down below, you put a heterodyne in there and everybody will hear that. So, and then similarly, if you're working your way down towards the lower band edge, you've got to ensure that you keep your displayed, suppressed carrier frequency at least 3 kilohertz away from that lower band edge, because that's where your signal, your lower sideband signal will go. So I thought it'd be helpful to take a look at these live, again on the radio here. But let me just stop sharing here for a moment and just maybe we'll just double check the chat to see if there's any questions there or not. It doesn't look like we have any. So let's actually go and share the restriction on your display here. So it looks like everybody should be able to see that here now. So I've actually got my little FT817 rig here that actually I've figured out needs a little bit of an alignment, but that's okay. We can get through this here. So to start off with, I've got this thing sitting up at the upper end of the 10-meter band. It's like 29.6 here. And if I just key up in CW, okay, we can actually see my carrier at 29.600. I can see the phase noise. This is actually just phase noise from my CW transmitter of the radio itself, so nothing to be too concerned about. But that's essentially my carrier frequency there. Now you'll notice if I start keying actually sending CW, instead of just getting a narrow little tone here, you'll see that can see that, as I said, there's a little bit more width in that spectrum. In fact, let's go, maybe we'll turn a max fold trace on here to go take a look at that. Okay. We can actually see when we're modulating, even CW, which is just turning a carrier on and off, we do occupy a little bit more bandwidth than just the pure CW tone by itself. It's just that act of turning it on and off is kind of the extreme case of amplitude modulation, right? Just turning the carrier on and off. So even though CW is a narrow band or a narrow mode, it's not zero, right? It does occupy some bandwidth, I mean, typically 200 hertz or less. The faster you tune, the faster your tone, the more bandwidth you actually occupy. So let's take a look at some of the other modes here. Let's go, let me switch my rig here to AM. Here. And let's go back to that same frequency. And there's enough noise picked up in the radio, in the audio circuit, that we just keep the microphone. We can see the carrier, and you can kind of see as I'm talking here, where the microphone is sitting about a foot away from where I'm talking, you can kind of see that the side bands on either side of that carrier are kind of equal and opposite. Right? I've got energy in the carrier, and I've got energy coming into the side bands. Okay, a better way to see this is I'm going to turn on a little audio generator here and get my phone turned on here. Let's turn that on. And I got a simple little audio tone being generated here. If I turn it up, you'll be able to hear it. Okay. And that simple audio tone you can see is creating a sideband that's just above and just below. It's about a 1 kilohertz tone. So the I've got a upper and lower sideband that's 1 kilohertz up and 1 kilohertz down from the carrier. If we change the frequency, and do that here. As I change the frequency, we can see how that sideband moves out. And everything remains symmetrical. Okay. And that's very typical of AM, is let me turn that off here. So AM creates that the carrier and the modulation sidebands. And even if, as we change that modulation depth, let's go back and do that, okay? As I change the amplitude of that signal going into the radio, you see the carrier magnitude doesn't change. Even if I'm bringing the mic up closer and further away from the audio source, you can see the carrier power remains the same. Even when I get to the point where I get close to essentially 100% modulation, we're never going to, the carrier power is always going to be there. And again, that carrier is not carrying any energy. Right? The carrier is just there to essentially complete the RF onboard of that RF signal. So it is kind of wasteful in terms of power. Let's take a look at what happens when we look at upper or lower sideband. So let's flip this over to, let's see, let's go to upper sideband here first, and I'll just cue the mic away from any other source. You can actually see there's just some noise in the audio circuit. And you can actually see, remember, my carrier is right here in the center, right? And but now I can see all of the energy is concentrated just on the one side. My lower side band essentially isn't there, being suppressed. And I can especially see that just by looking at that noise that's there. So that's what upper side band looks like. We remove the carrier, we remove the lower side band, and all the energy is now in the upper side band. So this is where my dial frequency is, right here at 29.6. But again, I've got energy extending out to 3 kilohertz or so above that. Let's switch it over to lower sideband here, MT and link. And now we can actually see that all the energy is down on that lower sideband. So the carrier is suppressed, nothing in the upper sideband here, and all the energy is down here now in the lower sideband. This becomes especially apparent when we start looking at that audio tone. Let me just bring that up. So there's that audio tone. When I'm not talking, you can see just that audio tone. Now you might say, you might recognize the fact that, well, that's just a CW tone that's offset from my displayed pulse carrier frequency by the audio tone frequency. But in some sense, it's no different than a CW signal. One way of generating CW signal is just to create an audio tone that goes into a single sideband transmitter. Okay, that's that's another way, and it's indistinguishable from a CW signal. In fact, most of the, I'm trying to software, speaking in my ear, most of the digital moves, you know, whether it's PSK31 or anything like that, that use the sound card to create tones and things like that, are literally just doing just that. They're creating tones, and you're even though the transmitter is in single sideband mode, or even if you're in some of these digital modes, it's actually in a single sideband transmission mode, and it's just creating those tones in the upper or lower sideband. And the receiver at the other end doesn't really care where it came from. It doesn't matter what that tone offset is. It's just going to decode the, you know, that signal, like the PSK signal, just look at the phase shift of that tone that's being created in audio, but then modulated on either the upper or lower sideband. So it's one way to kind of think about how all that works together. So the other thing we didn't really talk about is FM. And in FM, you might wonder, so why don't we use FM on the lower frequency bands, like on HF? And the reason is that FM occupies a lot more bandwidth than even AM does. Because AM, again, occupies twice the bandwidth of your audio signal, right? We talked about that. Because we've got an upper and lower sideband. With FM, the sideband generation is not just, it's related, obviously, to the audio signal that's modulating it, but you also get multiples of those sidebands. There's a whole function called a Bessel function that determines the strength of all these multiple sidebands. And let me show you what I mean by that. I'll switch the rig here to SM. Let me put that tone back on here again. I'll get my phone to turn back on here. Now, this is an FM signal. Same tone being sent in. Okay? And you can see I've got the same spacing, that 1 kHz spacing, for the audio tone, but I've also got another set of sidebands at 2 kHz, 3 kHz, 4 kHz offset. Okay? And the strength of those tones is a function of a couple of things, the modulation depth and the deviation. So you can see that the FM signal actually occupies a lot more bandwidth because there's more sidebands that are being generated. So we typically will do that only on the VHF and above bands because we've got a little bit more bandwidth to play with there, more frequency space to play with, so occupying 5, 10, 15 kilohertz of bandwidth doesn't hurt us. Occupying 15 kilohertz of bandwidth in an HF would be rather that's typically why we don't use FM on the lower frequency bands. And even if you look at broadcast signals, right? Broadcast AM, is down below 1.6 megahertz, right? It's just AM, so the bandwidth of the signal is equal to twice the audio bandwidth. But you get up into FM, typically 88 to 108 megahertz. And the occupied bandwidth of an FM broadcast signal is several hundred kilohertz because of this this multiple sideband generation that's needed in order to accurately get FM signals through. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting look at spectral content of different signals, what they look like, and some of the considerations that you might want to take into account when operating these different bands and how close you get to the band edges. Where your signal is, where the people you're talking to are listening to, and where you can safely tune up without interfering with them. So that's all I have for tonight. Just something, a simple topic, but sometimes I think a visual is worth a thousand words.
So. All right. Well, that was a great talk, and I like looking at the scope here, the spectrum analyzer, and seeing those sidebands here. All right, well, very good. Let's move on real quick to Bill Brown, and let's see what Bill's got for us tonight. It should be an exciting adventure with Bill tonight. Bill, give us an update on Dash 20. What's going on?
Sure thing. I have a question for Alan in a few minutes.
Okay, if you want to go ahead and ask that, go right ahead.
Alan, I have a question for you. Why is 40 meters and 80 meters lower sideband and 20 and above upper sideband? Is that just what is the reasoning behind that?
Well, I think, it's kind of tradition now, but I think in the early days it got down to a point where most of the rigs and gear that hams were using their upper and lower side bone came out of the military, actually military surplus and things like that, which used for one reason or another a very common 9 megahertz IF. Okay, so the first IF in the rig was 9 meg. So when you were doing your frequency conversion into that 9 meg IF, you would get spectral inversion when you were below 9 meg and not the spectral inversion when you were above 9 meg. So the spectral inversion would invoke that side band. Okay, so if we were using the lower side band, it made more sense. When you were converting the other direction, you were not inverting the spectrum, and therefore you'd use upper side band above 9 meg. So the 9 meg is really the limit line. So that's why in sort of 20 meters above 9 meg, 40 meters down below 9 megahertz. So I think that's where it kind of came from, and it's just been adopted as tradition. There's no technical reason why one is better than the other. It just came down to the equipment that was available to hands when they were experimenting with single sideband in the earlier days, and I think that's really where it came down.
And you know, that standard is still being used today, particularly like in aircraft when we're flying our jets. The aircraft radios, they don't have a lower and upper sideband switch on them.
Yeah, the only place where we really broke that was the 60 meter band, 60 meters yeah. upper side band, and because it's below 9 meg by rates, it should be lower, but it's upper.
Yeah. Hey, a question in the chat room. They like your presentation. Can you use it for teaching licensing classes? They want to know if they can use it, I guess, for teaching classes.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly, if somebody wants a copy of the quick little presentation, I can certainly make that available. If we can put it somewhere to download, that's fine, but I'd be happy to do that. If it's useful in any classes that you're teaching, I'd be happy to take advantage of that, no problem.
Oh, great.
Looks like Kyle had a question about the 262. Well, it wasn't a question, it was more of a statement. Okay. And read the resistance in your body with the 260, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah. And if you put the two test leads on your tongue, you can also taste it.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
What spectrum analyzer were you using today, Alan?
Well, actually, it actually wasn't a spectrum analyzer, it's an oscilloscope. The oscilloscope that I was using actually has a built-in digital down converter, so essentially it's got effectively a spectrum analyzer behind every channel. It now converts into baseband IQ like the software-defined radio does, and then computes the spectrum right from the IQ data right in the hardware. Pretty cool stuff. The benefits of working for Tech Line.
You know, we've got one question from... We've got another question from N8DPR. I think N8DPR may be new tonight with us. I don't know. N8DPR, you new tonight. Glad to have you. He says, why is FTA with 40 meters up inside there?
Yeah, well, that's, I guess that's the same reason. I think the FTA, the program that you use, the application you use on the PC, is using the sound card to create the frequency modulated signal that's used by FTA. And the software is designed to decode the signal, assuming the modulation is going in one direction or the other. So in this case, it's actually assuming that you're not converting the spectrum, you're going in one direction. So you want to impress the audio signal on the upper side then, so there's no spectral inversion of the audio signal. If it was transmitted on the lower side then, the spectrum would be inverted. The software could probably be written to accommodate for that, but I think for most of the digital modes, I just make the assumption that you're going to put the rig in upper sideband mode. And at the end of the day, kind of like I showed you with the CW standalone when you looked at single sideband, you select upper sideband, you put the tone or tones in there for your digital signal, which that's all that appears is just those tones. They're going to be offset from the suppressed carrier, the displayed carrier frequency. But it's just going to be essentially a frequency shifted version of the audio signal that the computer and sound card are making. And by putting it all on upper side band, you don't get any spectral inversion on it. So that's probably why most digital modes, including FTA, will use the rig in upper side band mode to create that narrow band modulated signal.
All right, cool. All right. If there's any more questions, Peter Chevron. We'll get into Alex. Also, Sam Allen, if you know if you're interested in that presentation, he can get it to you. All right, cool.
This compact rig weighs in just over 2 pounds with RF direct sampling for most of the HF bands and IF sampling for frequencies above 25 megahertz. It also has a large 4.3 inch color touchscreen with live band scope and waterfall. You get 5 watts with the BP272 and 10 watts with a 13.8 volt DC power supply. It has a micro USB connector, Bluetooth, and WLAN. Integrated GPS with antenna and a GPS logger. It has a micro SD card slot. And the ATM243 speaker microphone comes standard. The perfect accessory for the IC705 is the LC192 backpack. It has a special compartment for your IC705 and room for all your accessories. The IC705 now has received FCC certification, and we expect product to be shipping to dealers by the end of September. Visit www.icomamerica.com/amateur for more information on ICOM radios.
To QRO, fixed stations, portable and remote, an LDG tuner will match your radio to your antenna using our lightning-fast proprietary tuning algorithms. LDG is a family-owned and operated company dedicated to bringing innovative, quality products to the amateur market. All LDG products carry a full 2-year warranty that is fully transferable. Support is only a phone call or email away. We're always here to help you. Visit us on the web at LDGelectronics.com.
Okay, we're back, and here's Bill. Bill's with us. And Bill, tell us what's going on with W5KB-20, man. You know, we're gonna try to break a record of 3 revolutions in 72 days. I don't know if we can do it or not, but we're going to try. What's going on with it?
Well, it was moving right along, and then it decided to take a little southerly track across India, right through the central part of India. And when it's in that part of the world, there's not a lot of whisper stations to listen for it to get data back from it. Fortunately, I'm a member of the New Delhi Amateur Radio Club in India, and I alerted my friends there to start listening on whisper. And I think you had a guest on that did the microbit radio.
Thanks for
Was he listening for it as well?
No, I haven't contacted him. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I got 3 or 4 whisper stations that pop up in India as it was all on my Facebook plea, and they all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of whisper stations listening in India, and we got some really nice reports on your position as we came across India as a result. So it pays to have friends in remote places. So then it decided to go to Burma, which actually is called Myanmar now.
Yeah.
But it originally was called Burma. And I have a theory, it spent a whole day and a half going in circles over Burma. And I think you have some slides of what the giants were really looking for in Myanmar.
They were checking the signs out. Probably many people watching the show don't know what this is. They've never seen these. They don't know what these are. Let's see this. Alan. Alan's a pretty young guy. Alan, do you know what this is?
Yeah, I'll mute my microphone there. Yeah, I've seen the signs.
Okay.
I've seen the signs on the highway, and I remember seeing the signs sitting in the back of the station wagon as a kid.
Okay, there you go.
Highway, but that's about it.
Well, there they are, 1925 to 1963. Boy, when you drive down the highway, you look forward to seeing the Burma shooting signs.
Here's one example.
Yeah. And it's these signs out like every mile, so you'd read it and you'd have to wait for a mile to get the next little bit and the next little bit, you know.
And
And it's kind of reminds me of if you've ever traveled south on I-95 from down the East Coast through New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina. There are signs that start several hundred miles from the North Carolina-South Carolina border, or a little attraction called South of the Border.
Oh, yeah?
Be sure to visit south of the border and 272 miles.
You know, it's like every 50 miles is another sign.
And then when you go across South Dakota or North Dakota, I can't remember which, but there's Wall Drug is in the western part of the state, and as soon as you cross the border, every mile for about 400 miles, it says, see Wall Drug.
We've got off on Burma Street. Let's get back on track here.
This guy has apparently saw a bunch of Burma shaved signs over the country of Burma. Checking it out. So, but fortunately, they got through Burma, Myanmar, and they are now cruising through China. They made it into China last night, and on the western part, and they're picking up speed. They're finally getting into the jet stream again. And because you were kind of out of it and going to the circle.
So there we are. There was about 30 minutes ago, so we've traveled about another 25 miles, I guess, since it came on.
It's daylight over China right now, and so the balloon started transmitting about an hour or two ago, and it's near Shanghai. And hopefully it will go out east and hit the big jet stream and get across the Pacific Ocean in a day's time. We had a transmitter on the same balloon you're flying with one of my trackers on APRS that was over Japan 2 days ago, and it just showed up in San Francisco today. So if you hit the right winds across the Pacific, you can get across in a day or two.
I think you have a much better prediction, but here's what Nabo was showing, and I don't like what I'm seeing.
I just ran a manual prediction on...
Let's see what your prediction shows.
And mine shows it going, if I can share it here.
But this is not really common. All of our flights, we've made quite a number of circles. Okay.
So, can you see
it? I see it.
And cruising down to the Philippines.
Right.
It looks like it's going to spend 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days over the Philippine Islands.
7 days over the Philippines.
Right. And you're going almost down to the equator. You're going down below 10 degrees latitude. And some of my analysis shows there is maybe a 10 or 20% possibility you could actually catch the right winds and go into the southern hemisphere and start circling in the southern hemisphere.
Well, now, will we still be going west to east if we go down there?
Yes.
Yes.
If there's some time, you'd be going slower.
I did
a few calculations. It looks like you could potentially go down to Borneo and end up in Australia.
So I want to show you something here. If I go to Ventuski here, and if I go over to China.
But you're not sharing right now.
I'm sharing right now, yeah. So if we go over here to Ventuski, I'm looking at, let me go up to altitude here, as high as I can go. I'm going to go up to 36,000 feet, so. All right, now I'm at 36,000 feet. It's been loaded. And why is it not loading? Let me hit refresh to see that I don't. Maybe just follow it. I'm looking at picture. That's what's going on. I want to original picture. You've got a wind speed. Here we go. This little one right here. Okay. So here we go. We're at 38,000 here. And we're somewhere. I don't remember exactly where we were, Bill. We're somewhere
on the southern edge of that.
Right here now. That's showing the winds at 118 miles an hour, but they're all going east. So I don't know where we're getting this curve at, you know?
And right there, you can see there's a downward tilt, and if you are on the southern edge of that, you could get thrown out of the red stream into the slow vortex, just like you did over Burma yesterday.
So, if we can, I'd like to avoid that, but if we could stay up here and ride that 130 miles an hour all the way over to the United States.
Back to the U.S. in about a day and a half.
Yeah, that would be better. If you look at this same thing on Windy, let's go to Windy, and, well, there's some good speed points.
There's some good ones out there. Starting to get good.
I can't even tell what
this time of year.
I can't even tell where we are. I said, here's the United States. Now look at the speeds across. There's India right there. Look at the speeds across 155 miles an hour straight across. I don't know how we got off that little bitty pocket down there.
You went a little too far south.
Yep, and then, of course, so we're going to come across right here somewhere. We're going to hit the slowest if we can. This is probably the least. You can see the wind speed is 165, the wind speed here is back up to 128, and I don't know. Well, you just can't play with the other nation.
Where the Philippines are, you'll see there's hardly any wind at all. So if you get in that loop down to the Philippines, you're going to be circling there for about a week.
Oh, boy. Yep. All right.
Well, I have some good ham friends in the Philippines, and I'm going to see if I can get them to start listening on Whisper.
All right. Hey, I listened on several remote SDR receivers yesterday or the day before, somewhere around China, Burma, in that area. I didn't hear anything.
Kuwait City had good reception on it 2 days ago. That seems to be one of the most sensitive ones in the area. But a lot of them are not very sensitive on those remote SDR radios. You have to look at the signal to noise ratio when you click on their little icon.
Yeah. All right. So
that's the prediction. It looks like you could be hanging out over the region for a while before you pick up that, get circle back and pick up that jet stream. And like I say, there is a slight chance you could end up in the southern hemisphere. It's pretty rare, but it is possible. Andy VK3YT was able to send a balloon from Australia all the way up to Cuba. He crossed to Cuba, and then it went back down to the southern hemisphere again.
Well, right there is the equator, right there where the mouse is, and we may be getting close.
Yeah. Hmm. I had one flight, my sixth flight around the world. It circled above and below the equator like a sine wave. I go about 5 degrees up and 5 degrees south and 5 degrees north for just about the entire trip around the world.
Yeah.
It's also a riskier place because the storms are higher, and particularly that's getting into a tropical zone, so you're running more risk of bringing into big storms.
Well, that's all we want to do is avoid the storms, of course.
Yeah. But you got good signals that you were getting received by several in southern China, near Hong Kong, and Japan. And I saw one report in Alaska, too. That's a pretty good range.
Must have been that three-element beam I hung on there, that three-element wire beam.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, tell us just real quick, there's been a lot of interest in people ballooning, and you've been contacted a lot. You've done some stuff down in Australia recently.
I Yeah, there's two schools, Melbourne, Australia, that are been launching balloons, and they've been using that to teach their middle school students about the atmosphere and space and science. And I had a great Zoom call with a middle school class in Melbourne and, the other day, like I say, and it was really fascinating. Their balloon worked great. They unfortunately, it's on APRS, so there's not a lot of coverage over the ocean, so we hope it will show up eventually over Argentina or South Africa, or make it back to Argentina, I mean, back to Australia here in about another few days. But they've got, there's more on the way down there, so it takes a while to ship something to Australia, but they're going to be launched in a few, over the next few months.
Mm-hmm. All right. Oh. Well, let's move on with Glenn, I guess. Anybody got any questions or comments?
There was somebody in the chat room wanting Bill's email address.
Okay, Bill, they want your email address.
WBATELK at Gmail.
All right, very good. Look him up on QRV, WBATELK, if you can't remember it.
There you go. And you can, I can post that in the chat room, but I'm not in the chat room.
Alan did it. Also, you can get Alan's email by QRZ if you go to W2AEW, and you'll be able to get his email too. There it is. He just posted it. All right. All right. Well, so, you know, Blaine is saying, asking me to send him an email so I can tell him how to make this thing work. I don't understand why he can't get chat and the email at the same time. I think he's the only one that has told me that. So, Dwayne, I don't know if you're looking at chat or video right now. Open up a second browser. Open up a browser, like Chris said. Open up one browser for video. You can just make that browser half the page and then open another browser. From the chat room and make that half a screen, and you should get both of them on here.
I've got a neat little device here, Tom, that it's a kid's toy that when I went Christmas shopping, and it's a LED ring, and it's made for doing TikTok videos and that kind of stuff for the kids. But it's since my lighting situation is always bad, I found a little tripod, and it didn't cost very much. I picked it up at a Hobby Lobby store. Kind of.
That's cool. We need to get you a few more of those. Just put them all around
here. I'm going to get more and just line them up here. My neighbor will be blinded whenever I show up on the show here.
Okay, hey, we've got a person in the chat room, Okinawa. He says hello from Okinawa. This is 7J1ADJ/RJ6. So, all right, Okinawa, stick around. If it goes down, we're going to want to send you out as a search party to collect it for us.
Yeah, tell him to get on the Whisper because he's in good RF range of it right now. He should be able to hear your balloon.
And the Okinawa person, as Bill said, if you've got WSJT-X, it's the Whisper program. And you can put it on your computer there and your radio, and you can... You can pick up W5KUB-20 because you're in range right now.
Where are you sitting? Where are you on the 20-meter band on Whisper?
Yeah, 20 meters.
Mm-hmm. Is that like 14.07?
14.0956.
0956, okay.
And right now, there's some station in Russia running FT8 on there making or prototype, and in a VH position. 14.0956. Have you heard that, Bill?
Yeah, I know. Carrying up the
mountain. I thought it was prototype, but Yeah, maybe it already told like that. I don't know. Someone said it was an FTH. I don't know.
Oh, really? No, I'll have to look at it. Listen to it again. Earlier I was listening and it sounded like a big, strong teletype.
Yeah. I think it was RTTY. Yeah. All right. Very good.
Well, if he gets out of the doldrums there over the Philippines, then you hit that jet stream and you'll be back in the U.S. in no time. Because once you hit that strong winds, you'll be sailing across the Pacific and, like I say, going over 100 miles an hour.
You know, I was thinking, we've been in here now about 10 days, I think. We don't have to go Saturday, maybe 10 days. Around the balloons, I think it averaged around 17 days to get around. Although, this past month, I've seen some people getting around the Earth in, what, 8 days? 9 days, maybe?
URW launched 17 days ago, and there have been some that made it around in 11 to 12 days.
Yeah, okay.
Because now we're getting into the good winds, the wintertime, late fall, early winter wind patterns, and if you hit it right, you can really sail across quickly.
So let me ask about one more. KO6FE, I couldn't find him today. Is it still on reporting?
I didn't see any reports from him today. I'll have to take a look. And he looked like he was stuck over in a circle in the Pacific Ocean, however.
Yeah, he's been moving.
Alpha Bravo 5, Sierra Sierra Dash 14. I've been running the Python program for him to track his. And the Python program takes the WhisperNet data, converts it to APRS, and sends it to APRS. It's a program I wrote in Python. And so I have it running for his balloon since he's a friend of mine. And his is going around the world, and I think his was 17 days.
We're about 13, so I don't think we're going to take 17.
The Mylar balloons stacked on top of each other.
Oh, yes. That's cool.
And he made it completely around the world. That's kind of hard to do on those small...
I think soon we'll try to experiment. We're gonna tape together three or four of those big round clear ones and five or six of those Mylars all together, man. Maybe throw a net over them, box them all together. Okinawa says 7Q7RU is using FP8 and he has a pile up. So maybe you don't know that a whisper frequency. Or that might be a good place to operate RTTY because most all the other signals are going to be weak there, right?
Yeah.
There may be a logical thinking here.
Well, they may not even be hearing the whisper signal.
They're probably not.
Yeah. Okay. Question in the chat room there. Somebody's want to know whose balloon is WB8? ORW-8.
WB0URW-8. Arrived. That was launched in Pella, Iowa, where we had the Great Plains Super launch a few years ago. Uh-huh. And they have an active balloon program. They're flying one of my SkyTracker APRS 4s on a SBS 13 balloon, the same balloon that you're flying the bomb. And he showed up right at the Golden Gate Bridge today, so after crossing the Pacific. It was kind of neat. All of a sudden, I was looking at the West Coast, and he popped right up right over San Francisco.
Well, yeah, watch that bridge.
From leading his first flap around the world.
You know, it seems like to me the first one you launched for us, it seemed like it flew around 29,000 or 30,000. It was a Mylar balloon, but I think it went over Mount Everest.
Yeah.
And that's getting pretty close, man. What's the altitude at Everest is like, what, 28,000?
29,000. And I had a, they had this device called an InReach by Delorme. It was a GPS tracker that had an Iridium modem in it, so you could send your position from anywhere in the world. And I was modifying it to use on balloons, but when I flew it, when I tried to fly it on a balloon, it would stop recording at 29,028 feet. That was the max altitude I could get out of it. So I asked the engineers at the Warming why this was happening, and he says, well, we didn't think anybody would be hiking higher than Mount Everest.
Right.
Oh, it is a little hard to do that.
Well, see.
They had designed it for people in remote areas and hiking, and they never thought about using it for high altitude balloons.
Okay. 15-second story is not ham related, but since we're talking about Everest. So last night I was watching King of Queens, and he had this book about climbing Mount Everest. And his wife and he went to some big party with his wife's boss, who was a climber. And the boss asked, "Do this to climb?" And yeah, he says, "How high?" He says, 29,200 feet. He says, "What?" He says, "It's Everest." And he says, "Yeah." Well, and then later in the conversation, you know how the non-climbers sometimes false bike, they lose a toe or whatever, you know. I mean, if they have the amputee anyway. He was telling the boss that he lost a toe pulling up there. And the boss said, well, when did you know, you lose the toe? He says, I don't know. He says, I just took my shoe off and it was gone. Oh, man. Maybe the audience maybe caught it. It's kind of like, you know, it wasn't amputated. It was just the toe was gone when you took the shoe off, man.
All right. Let's get over that down to 200 feet.
Yeah, what? Well, man?
Yeah, 150 feet above Everest, I'd be losing a lot more than a toe.
Yeah. All right.
What do you got going tonight, man? What I got going?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm still working on the book just as hard as I can. By my estimate, I'm down to about 7 to 10 days to finishing. And let's see if I can't find the screen that I've got popped up here. I've got a screen. There we go. There it is. Let's try this. There we go. Wait for my computer to get its act together.
You need a bigger UPS supply. We're not getting that screen.
Yeah, it's working. And it has been. I'm using Windows 7, and that's to convert video and stuff, present, make it format compatible. And it's there we go.
Well, it hadn't got here yet from Mississippi.
There it is.
It made it.
There it is.
There's nothing in there.
No, there's nothing in there, huh? That is actually a MOSFET driver for the Peltier controller. I've got a project here.
Yeah.
This is the actual controller for it. Uses an infrared temperature sensor. Like the ones they use in the handheld things, they take your temperature at the store. Mm-hmm. And this is basically designed to be a touch-free or fan-free, no-contact temperature sensor that will drive a Peltier cooler. And there's the module. It's attached to a CPU heat sink. And it's got a fan on it. That was just for testing. But you're talking about 150-degree temperature difference, you know, between the cold side and the hot side.
How much does that thing weigh? Let's put it on the balloon.
Well, the cooler itself, it probably weighs about the weight of a dollar coin, maybe.
Now, doesn't that thing make heat on one side and cold on the other side?
Yes, so it's 150 something degrees difference.
How cold can you get it from room temperature?
Minus 158 degrees for room temperature.
That's what you need to test your LiPo batteries out there.
Those are the toothpick to keep one side of room temperature when you start doing that.
Well, that's why I put the fan on it, just to see how cold I can really make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, we've got an IR sensor that's actually sensing right at that heat junction there.
How much power does it take to drive that to get the 450 degree temperature?
6 amps at 12 volts, 72
watts. That's going to take a lot of solar cells.
Yeah, you're going to need more solar cells.
Okay, we used to use those little Peltier coolers going back, let's see how many years ago. With my first job out of college, I worked for a company that we did fiber optic data links. And one side of the house, we used FabricPro laser diodes. And we actually used the Peltier coolers on the optical bench of the laser diodes to tune the lensing frequency of the diodes.
The thing is, they've gotten so cheap now. I mean, that's like an inch and a half by an inch and a half square. You know, and I found a bundle of them on clearance for a buck each, you know.
The ones we used were teeny tiny. They were probably, you know, a tenth of an inch or two-tenths of an inch on a side. They were really small because they would go inside of a bathtub, like 16-pin dip-style package. With the laser mount on top of that, and then a thermistor in there to kind of hold temperature, and then it was kind of set into a circuit with a feedback loop to kind of maintain the laser at a given temperature for WDM applications.
So, Glenn, what are you going to use this for? What do we do with it?
It was just one of those fanless cooler ideas. Let's say I had a rig that I wanted to cool without using a fan. I wanted it silent.
Yeah.
I could do something like this. And I, you know, my original thought was, with all the COVID stuff, it'd be cool to build my own hands-free thermometer. And as it turns out, the hobby module versions of that infrared detector are only accurate to within about a half of a centigrade, so that's like 2 degrees. They do make a medical version that's far more accurate, but I didn't get that. I just got the standard one. And that's when I came across this idea. And, of course, you've got to monitor it, and the temperature sensor actually can sense temperature and ambient temperature simultaneously. So you've got your room temperature and then the temperature of the object you're getting the temperature from.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm driving you with PWM, because literally with these Peltier coolers, if you put your fingers on both sides of it, the heat it pulls from your finger will actually cook the finger on the other side. It gets that hot that fast. So that's one of the book projects that we've got going. This is another one of the book projects we've got going. We're still not playing. My room's being destroyed. But this is actually a rotor position indicator. We tap off of the rotor potentiometer coming down, and that's actually a circular LED behind that little silver mask, and it will actually point in the direction, because you look at this meter, like, it says it's east. Okay, really? I have to do the translation on my head, which direction is east. This way, the little LED will point. And we also followed that up with this other one here. Do you remember those old 60s commercials for the Mercury Cougar with that blinking tail, the flashing tail, the sequential LEDs? Well, that's what this is. While your rotator is turning, it will sequentially blink the LEDs in the direction that your antenna is rotating.
And it'll be a neat addition to that project, then.
Well, there's actually both of those are in the same phone book.
I was going to say, a neat addition to that project is if Ben McCullough, you could build in the beam width of your Yagi.
Oh, yeah.
should indicate by intensity where your main logos and where it's fading out on either side to kind of get an idea in your compass setting of how far off the side you are.
Yeah, you could. Now, this ring is only a 12 LED ring, so that's going to cover 30 degrees per pixel.
Yeah.
But they make much larger ones. They've got a 4.5-inch diameter ring that has 60 LEDs.
Okay.
And you can actually, you could easily do beam width within that one.
Even like intensity gradient, so you get to the edge of the beam width, have the LED be a little bit dimmer, kind of be an intensity.
Well, these are RGB LEDs, so you can do anything.
Yeah, cool.
You know, they're PWMs, so you can dim them and brighten them, so you can literally do exactly what you're talking about. The edges could be dim,
yeah.
The center could be bright.
Yeah, very cool.
And those are only like $5 for those LED rings. They're very cheap. And then this is the mod itself to get the fact that the antenna is rotating. We actually read the switches here and we bring them to optocouplers because you're bringing in about 30-something volts in there. And so we use optocouplers to isolate those signals and then feed it over to the Arduino at 5 volts.
That's cool, man. That's cool. So you could just about put that on any rotor that has a potentiometer in it, could you?
Yes. The book we're doing it for the ASU, G450, 800, 1000, and the CDE high gain. 90% of the CDE high gains, they all have virtually the same circuit. They haven't modified that circuit since 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing they added was a break. And everything they got, the diagram is the same one they did from the 50s.
And they must have a lot by a perforard.
Oh, gosh, that's the number one thing I buy. The perforard there, and let's see. Then I buy the Arduino Proto boards, and that actually is a shield that stacks on top of an Uno. Mm-hmm. And the enclosure is built for an Arduino Mega. So it's got that extra space, and I use that extra space to put my switches and connectors and stuff, and it fits it in just perfectly in there.
Yeah, one of our followers, viewers here, contacted me. He writes Whisper software, and he's designed this one, Whisper transmitter, Arduino-based. And I think I'm going to build that. I'm going to get with him here soon. We'll probably do something like it on the show here. And build that. I still want to build that Whisper receiver that was in that magazine we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
But I'm having trouble sourcing some of the parts here. You got any other projects there you want to show us? Or was that the two you're going to feature tonight?
That's what I'm going to feature tonight. I think it just hit the floor. The janitor came in and decided it was time to clean my desktop. This is the next project.
Oh, man.
And we even have pictures in here. I don't have those up on the screen yet. But what we are going to do with this one, find one of the pictures here, we are going to take the AR-40, the iGain AR-40 rotator controller. We're going to build one from scratch and interface it with Ham Radio the Mux. And then we're going to take an existing one and modify it. And that's what's in this next chapter.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
And I'll be able to show that next week.
All right. Well, hey, Dwayne in the chat room says he wished he had internet, satellite internet. I guess he's got some kind of internet problem. So, you guys may remember Exceed. This is, I forget who this is, but this is the guy from Exceed. And if you guys remember, for about 3 years at Dayton, Exceed put in a satellite internet for us, and we had our own satellite link there at Dayton to webcast with. And it was pretty good service. And if you're interested, you can contact Exceed. He said there were no carriers that you can get, but EXEDE, Exceed, and they can get you some internet out there probably. All right. Guys, we finished just a few minutes early tonight. What else is going on? Anybody else got anything interesting you're working on here?
Well, I'm hoping to have time to build a ready reader that you'll actually just feed audio from your rig and have it display ready on one of those little 2-inch color CRT displays.
I saw a video today. It reminds me, I saw a video on YouTube. 1960 technology. It was on the BBC. And they invented this CW to a typewriter interface. And they had this guy there studying, and he goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- This guy, he could spit the code out with his mouth real fast. And I said, well, this is a new invention. And, it's like, what about people that are blind? I mean, you can type now. But all you have to do is learn Morse code and go, da-da-da-da, or whatever, I'm thinking, gee, that would be a simpler way in 1969 to do that.
Yeah. It was
funny. He sent a command by, and then he says, now I'm going to dial this telephone with it. And he sent a command, and he made a phone call by sending Morse code. Oh, man, it didn't look very efficient to me, but...
They were just experimenting with new technologies back then. I mean, think about this. In that era, you're talking about, they didn't have automatic doors at the grocery store. That was a Star Trek thing, and even when we saw it on Star Trek, we were like, there's no way you can do a door that we're not going to walk into. It's not going to be smart enough to know that we're standing in the middle of the door. And now, look at what you've got. I mean, you don't even think twice when you walk into the grocery store.
There have been a lot of developments since then. I mean, I was overseas in Asia in 1971, 72. No internet. I mean, I had to write a letter back home to my wife. And to make a phone call, I had to go to the telephone building and get in line. And the operator would actually make a call from the States. It might take 30 minutes to get that connection, today, it would have been so nice to have email back then, it's, wow.
Back then, HF and phone patches for the guys overseas was the big thing.
Yeah.
And you could tune in on 20 meters almost any time if somebody was running a phone patch for somebody.
Yeah.
Who runs phone patches anymore?
My phone patches are on the top shelf in the closet now.
The technology, it's just getting faster and better every day. The things we thought were impossible are now commonplace. For example, I was just watching a little video earlier. What is that new show they've got on? It's one of the streaming services, The Mandalorian. Is that Disney? But the Star Wars TV series, they're using an Arduino now to power their stop-motion physical shots. The special effects shots that are being powered by an Arduino and a 3D camera head.
All right, before we go tonight, let me ask the people in the chat room. Guys, we've done some audio work here the last couple of weeks. We added a Behringer Compressor Pro limiter compressor, and it's set up, and it's supposed to try to level out the audio. Has the audio been fairly level tonight? I noticed with the compressor on, the audio sounds a little different to me, but it seems like it's keeping the loud spikes and stuff down. I can probably turn it off for a second. I'm going to turn the compressor off. I'll see what it sounds like.
All right, the So I don't know if it's going to make a lot of difference or not. That kept me in a chip.
Yeah, they're saying you're way too hot.
Yeah, it's real hot. So I'm going to turn the compressor back on.
It says
something about the area left and right thing. I would say,
yeah, the I got the compressor back on now, so it's limiting it. But what did it say about right and left?
Was there, left and right, your stereo is out of phase.
Out of phase, okay. I need to fix that.
I think I tuned in through the recording that I did last week, and I noticed as soon as the audio came on, it something sounded weird in my ears, and maybe that's
yeah,
wrong.
Okay. Any ideas on how to fix the phasing on that?
Not a clue.
There's something about Mark says the commercials are correct. Well, Mark, the commercials are a video file I run on the computer where they're not audio coming into the compressor. So there's something to do with the tip and ring and sleeve on these, on the, and another thing too, the, a lot of the tracks here that we plug in are stereo to mono converting jacks. So,
Ryan's saying that they're hearing a guest on the left side only, so we may have a stereo and a mono missing somewhere.
Well, I'm seeing Bill when you talk. I see you on both channels.
Yeah, but it makes sense to make it mono if the pliers in together.
Yeah.
You may see me on both channels, but something may be shifting me out of phase somewhere further down the line.
Yeah.
When I do my videos or anything for YouTube, you know, there's no reason for me to leave things on stereo, so I typically do my rendering model just so that I don't have to worry about if I was too far to one side of my camera or stereo microphone or the other. I just let it render in mono.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into this. I'm not sure what to do, where to do it, to tell you the truth.
I'm a digital guy. I can't help you there.
Yeah, I need an audio engineer for me.
Not me. I don't have ears for it. My ears got blown out all the concerts I went to in the 70s.
Hey, Glenn, you said you're a digital guy. I got a question the other day. A guy watched my tutorial on IQ signals, and he said, hey, that was really good. I really learned how to do something. Do you know how to do that in Verilog? And I told him, I said, I'm an analog guy. The only thing I know about Verilog is how to spell it.
I don't even know how to do that. Verilog's probably my weakest point. You know, I came up from the field era and transitioned into transistors and did a little bit of analog there. But once I got my hands on digital, it was Katie bar the door, and that was what I was good at.
Well, you know, I was hoping Martin would be here tonight.
We're going to talk
about the analog part for sure. And I mean, Martin's a sharp. Yeah, I'm sure he knows all about digital, but, back when we started doing it, and you guys too, that's all it was out there, just the analog stuff.
Yeah, no. All I've ever done is analog design, analog integrated circuit design, discrete design, analog.
Yeah, for me, transistors were meant to be switches and nothing else.
Well, I learned about everything in between those two extremes.
Yeah.
Getting there.
But see, if I need one of those, I go and get an op amp. Those I can figure out.
Well, that's just a pile of transistors, anyway.
Yeah, but it's simpler.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, hey, let me just make an announcement again, guys. We're on WBCQ, International Shortwave Station, WBCQ. We've just moved to 7490 kilohertz. Back in my day, that was kilocycles. I can remember now. You think about it.
Yeah, when they changed that, but I liked it back in kilocycles, man.
Yeah, what's the difference? Anyway, so we're going to be on Thursdays. This show will be on Thursdays between 5 and 7 p.m. Eastern Time on 7490 kilohertz on WBCQ shortwave station. So if you're listening out there on shortwave, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Send that email to Tom at tom@w5kub.com, tom@w5kub.com. And let us know where you're at, and give us a signal report. We'd love to hear from you. And if you're interested in ham radio, that's what the show has been all about tonight. Many different aspects of ham radio. You can join the show on Tuesday nights if you have internet by going to w5kub.com, and you can watch the show and join in the chat room. And also, we'd like to invite everybody out there to join our Facebook group. We have a Facebook group for this show, our Amateur Radio Roundtable, and that Facebook group now has over 11,000. That is 11,000 hams. I didn't think we'd get there, but it's going every day. Join us. Just put in W5KUB. It'll take you to it. You can actually see the name of the show. The show is called Amateur Radio Roundtable, and it'll also take you there. And we'd love to have you. Post your pictures in there. A lot of people will post shack pictures. Katie will probably pull your shack pictures off, and we'll have a review of all your shack pictures on the show one night. But yeah, there's all, if you're interested in ham radio, it's not just talking radio, as you saw tonight. There's a lot of different things, like what Clint Propel's doing, and our balloon launches that Bill's involved in, and there's so much to do in ham radio. I don't think you could do it all in a lifetime, man. It's 9:32 p.m. Central Time, so I think we're going to go ahead and close the show here in just a minute. I got a package in the mail today. It was a water pump that goes on a dishwasher. So I know what I'll be doing in a few minutes. I'm going to be underneath the dishwasher changing the pump out.
I've got a dryer that had a heating coil go bad. They replaced that. Now the drum won't rotate, so I think they had a wire fall off or something. But I pay people to do that.
Things get complicated nowadays. I mean, when I grew up, I could work on a 57 Chevy. I could crawl into a dash. I could trace the three or four wires that were under there. But it's not today, man. It's impossible.
You know, there's this meme going around on Facebook about, you know, when you bought a car in the 50s, the owner's manual included how to set the valve spacing.
Set the valve top, valve tappet clearances and everything, yep.
Yeah.
I bet you can't even find the points on the car today.
Well, no. Well, it's all electronic. The actual coil is on top of each spark plug rather than a separate distributor coil.
Yep, and that's where dwell pack meters are sitting, collecting dust in the cabinet in the garage.
Hey, Ron, K9, real quick, breakthrough here, K9ID Ron, our buddy Ron up here. He looked at the right and left channels here. He opened up an audio editor, and he says, definitely they're out of phase. So, Ron, help us, man. I got to figure out how to get them back in phase. That should mean just taking one side somewhere and flipping it over, I would think. But I'm not sure.
Only in your main mixer.
I'm not sure.
Are they out of phase by 180 degrees, or is it something less than that? If they're 180, then it's an inversion issue that's easy. But if they're out of phase by something not 180, then that gets tricky.
Let's take two wires and flip them over.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, hey, that's what Bob Heil does on his headset. You know, he's got a headset out there.
Yeah, it's got a little switch on the side of the headset.
This is a Heil ProSet 3 right here. And there's a little switch. There's a little switch on this side right here, a little toggle switch. For phasing, and all it does is it just turns one earphone over opposite of another one. It just switches it. So I've got to add this switch into our show.
Looks like Ron said he's going to send you an email with a screenshot. So from that, you should be able to turn it. It's only 80 degrees out, then it's going to flip one.
Alan is the one that's got all the high tech stuff there. He can. He can tell us what to do. I don't like the sound of the audio, actually. To me, it sounds a little funny. And I'd like to try to fix that. All right, I'm gonna turn the compressor off.
And you ran your lapel mic,
I'm gonna try to crank the volume down so I don't clip here. So, all right, now guys, comment to me. I'm sure the audio probably sounds better out there in the chat room. So the compressor is off now. And
you know,
I backed
nobody
the.
Nobody complained about the phasing until you went to the compressor. So it may be. Yeah, now they're in the chat room. They're saying the phase problem is gone. So it's something with your compressor connections.
The phase problem is gone now? Yeah, I would imagine so, because before I put the compressor in, it sounded normal to me. Now, the compressor has a relay in there. This compressor is actually designed where if you turn the power off, it bypasses it. So that's what I did. I turned the power off, and it bypassed the compressor. So it's got to be something, I don't know.
Now, Russ is saying the grounds of both have to be connected. I think that would be a given.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something to do with your compressor doing it or the wiring of the compressor.
Did you try your lapel mic? Is that wired in through that compressor?
Yeah, everything goes through the mixer, and then it goes through the compressor. So that's going to sound
everybody was out of phase. So
it's going to sound the same. Let's see. I'm on the Heil mic now. Heil mic 1, 2, 3, 4. And there's the lapel mic 1, 2, 3, 4 lapel mic. And there's the Heil mic 1, 2, 3, 4 PR40 1, 2, 3, 4. And the lapel mic 1, 2, 3, 4. Should be able to tell a little difference. I don't need this now. All right, let's see what they're saying. Hey, maybe we'll have someone here that tells us exactly what to do.
Andy said, try changing the compressor oil.
I may have to change the compressor oil. You know what? This is one of those oilless compressors. Yeah, this is an oilless compressor.
What are those? What do they call those? The scroll compressors?
Yeah.
They call them loud.
Yeah, and mine is pretty loud out in my shop. Yeah, let's see. Okay. The grounds of both must be connected together. Well, I'll have to look at that, and we'll see.
Well, also, you've got multiple channels. Well, I guess it's if everybody's got the inversion, then it's got to be something that the tail end after you've mixed everybody together. So, interesting. Well, there's multiple channels on that thing. Maybe you could switch channels, you know, and see if the inversion stays with that. But that's something that if you got a two-channel scope there, it'd be pretty easy to put a test tone in on left and right at the input, and then look at the phase at the output, and just work your way through it that way.
Yeah. So if they're out of phase, I guess they're canceling each other. How can anybody even hear us out there?
Well because they have to go through your brain matter, and your brain matter kind of takes away the perfect 180.
Yeah, well, that's something I'm going to look into this week. Maybe by showtime next week, we do something. I don't know what it is.
All right.
I don't know. Okay, guys, I'm going
to... I was going to say, real quick, you've got to remind me, the very first show that I was on, is that when I did the Nano VNA talk then?
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Yeah, I'm actually giving that one again tomorrow night to a group of about 300 on Zoom.
Yeah, okay. Okay. All right, everybody. Thanks, everybody. We'll say goodnight to everybody. Glad you joined us tonight. We're going to end. Let's see. I'm going to end this thing with something. I don't know. I always look for the... I don't have any good thing to end it with tonight.
We're going to to get you some new good stuff.
Yeah. Let's just end it with the Glenn Popel lookalike again. Here we go.
I am going to.
So you're saying I can ask this cat any question?
The cat is connected to the computer. You just type in the question.
Doesn't he look like Glenn?
His mind.
That looks like the cat if they took away the white.
There's the answer, Cole.
Look like Glenn.
You're the man. I've been looking for this for weeks.
All right, guys. Good night, everybody. We're going to end the show. See you later.